You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
My name's Ethan Zuckerman. I'm the director of the Center for Civic Media at MIT, and we are co-hosting this event along with the Berkman Center. But we're really thrilled to bring these organizations together to bring a friend of both centers and a friend of the internet as a whole, Rebecca McKinnon, here for the Boston launch of her book, Consent of the Networked. We're working on full branding here in as many ways as possible. Rebecca's in the midst of a book tour, and we are her third stop. So I'm hoping we're going to be able to make her welcome here. Before I turn this over to Rebecca, I just want to talk a little bit about my dear friend and colleague who's now standing uncomfortably over here. But
what's he going to say?
we had this really wonderful conversation at a faculty meeting this past week at the MIT Media Lab, and talked about the fact that many of the people at the Media Lab who are most admired and most respected are people who've reinvented themselves multiple times. And as Rebecca and I were sort of talking earlier today, I think she's on at least her third career, if I'm counting correctly. But in certain parts of the world, Rebecca walks into a room and people know her immediately because for many years she was the face of CNN in Beijing, and then later in Tokyo as bureau chief in both of those great cities. She then went on to a phase that I'm very proud to have shared with her, where while we were both over at the Berkman Center, we founded Global Voices, which Rebecca now chairs the board of. It's an international news organization based around citizen media. In the last couple of years, Rebecca has been sort of emerging in a new identity, which I think may be the most socially relevant and politically powerful of the three, which is as a deep thinker and critic of how we're using the internet and the ways in which we might step up and become better citizens and better netizens. And so the book that she's launching tonight and this week is really, I think, one of the first coherent explorations of what it might mean to be a netizen, what it might mean for all of us in all of the services and the tools we use to take the responsibilities of being good citizens as well as just being consumers and users. So I'm just thrilled that Rebecca's here. If we could just get a round of applause to welcome her. Quick ground rules for the evening. This event is completely on the record. It's being videotaped. It's being blogged. It's being tweeted. If you don't want to be involved with those things, it would be a good time to put a jacket over your head or perhaps sit behind the screen, but this is very much a public event. Rebecca's going to talk a little bit about the book. We've invited a couple of our dear friends, who I'll introduce at the time, to offer reactions to it. And we're going to try to keep the whole thing within pace so that there's plenty of time for Q&A. There will be opportunities to get books signed afterwards. We'll be especially enthusiastic about them if you buy those books, which we're also selling on the other side of the wall. But with no further ado and fewer marketing pitches, Rebecca
McKinnon. Well, thanks very much, Ethan. Before I start, just again, thank you. Thanks to MIT Media Lab for hosting me, but thanks particularly to Ethan, not only for inviting me to talk here today, but for being such a fabulous friend and colleague, and for really providing a great deal of inspiration, ideas, and support along the way. And I don't think I'd be in the same place intellectually or professionally if I hadn't known Ethan and worked with Ethan. So thank you so much for being you. So just to get going here, how many of you have seen the famous Super Bowl commercial that aired in 1984 that Apple put out? How many of you have seen that? Right. Okay. How many of you have seen the Tunisian mashup version of that commercial? A few of you. Okay. So the rest of you, this may be new.
Okay.
This mashup was made in 2004 by a Tunisian activist who, at the time, we knew only as Astrobal, his pseudonym, and we later came to know as Riyad Ghirfali. It was titled Aziza's Dream, the idea that this girl was having a nightmare and would one day wake up. And amazingly, last year, it sort of happened, you know, that Ben Ali's regime was brought down in part thanks to a great deal of effort by internet activists who'd been working for the better part of a decade, actually long before Facebook and Twitter actually existed, to combat censorship, to raise awareness about the regime's abuses, and to spread viral videos like this one. Now, of course, there's been a great deal of discussion about the role that the internet has played in the Arab Spring and in Tunisia and Egypt, elsewhere in the Middle East and North Africa, the role it's been playing in political change and challenges to authority in a lot of other countries. And what my book deals with is less the question of to what extent did internet activists actually play a major role in bringing down Ben Ali in Tunisia or Mubarak in Egypt? Or to what extent did Facebook play a role? Or to what extent did Twitter play a role? And it's more about the question, rather than, are the good guys winning on the internet or the bad guys winning on the internet? How do we ensure that the internet evolves in a manner that remains compatible with democracy? Because while the internet played some kind of role, and it's debatable still exactly how much and to what extent social networking was critical in bringing people into the streets or not, but the internet did play some kind of role in bringing down a few regimes. It's playing a role in a lot of people saying no to a lot of other authority figures around the world. But to what extent is the internet going to be able to help the people of Tunisia and Egypt and elsewhere in the world to build a long-term sustainable democracy? And that is much less clear. And what's quite interesting in Tunisia, this is Moez Chakchuk, the head of the Tunisian Internet Agency. And he gave a speech this past fall, a couple of different speeches, actually, in which he revealed that under the Ben Ali regime, his agency had been testing, basically beta testing, censorware and surveillance technology on the behalf of Western companies that then the government got to use for free, and which then the companies then marketed around the region. But just because the Ben Ali regime fell actually does not mean the end of censorship and surveillance in Tunisia or debates surrounding them. So actually in May of last year, several months after Ben Ali's regime was disbanded and a transitional government was formed and the country began to prepare for elections, censorship returned. At the demand of a number of groups who were concerned about pornographic material being readily visible on the internet and feeling that in an Islamic society this was inappropriate. And so a number of Facebook pages and other pages began to be blocked again. And this is the block page that activists took a screenshot of, which says this page has been censored at the request of the military tribunal. And those pages are still being blocked, and there's currently a big debate going on in Tunisia about to what extent in a democratic society, now that they've elected a constituent assembly and they're writing their constitution, To what extent is censorship appropriate in a democratic country? To what extent is surveillance appropriate in terms of fighting crime? Who decides what gets censored? Who decides how surveillance is conducted? And how do you prevent them from abusing their power? And these sound like perhaps familiar questions. And this is the thing, that these questions, we here in the United States are kind of debating these questions. And Moaz Chakchuk on Twitter just a few weeks back tweeted in response to somebody's question, you know, nothing is decided. We're still debating this. NGOs, activists have to strengthen their efforts or we may not win this battle. And so a lot of the activists, including Riyad Ghirfali, who made that mashup, are trying to make the case that, no, we must not have censorship. We have to fight bad speech or troubling speech with more speech. If we start going down this slope again, particularly in a new and fragile democracy, we're just opening ourselves up for basically going back to where we were. And people are very concerned about that. And it's very unclear exactly where things are going to go. But one of the things about internet users in Tunisia and the question about how free or unfree or what is going to be the nature of the internet that people in Tunisia get to use, it's not entirely up to the people of Tunisia or the government of Tunisia. There are a lot of factors that are beyond all of their control that might affect their freedom. And so this is where kind of the traditional notion of sovereignty is beginning to change. Because in the United States, we could pass a law that affects the way in which Facebook or Google operates, and that could affect how Tunisian activists can use these social networks. And so, you know, even if you do have your democratic sovereignty kind of worked out in your own democratic nation state, other nation states may be having an impact on your ability to express yourself in ways that you're not able to hold accountable because it's being done by other governments. And, you know, sometimes nation states, let's say, you know, to continue on with the United States, sometimes it's quite useful that one nation state might kind of advocate on behalf of the freedoms of other people in other nation states. And, you know, Hillary Clinton at the State Department has been advocating this internet freedom policy and trying to get kind of world governments to pledge to the idea of a free and open internet. But then at the same time, you know, you have laws like our Congress recently tried to pass Stop Online Piracy Act that would have, in the name of protecting copyright, imposed liabilities on internet service providers and intermediary platforms that would have required that the intermediaries basically police and monitor their users in order to prevent copyright violation. But that would then put into place kind of a set of norms and infrastructure that end up becoming very convenient for a government in Tunisia that's trying to maintain its power and is very troubling to activists in Tunisia for this reason, because they're worried that as they themselves are having this debate about how much censorship should we have and so on, the legislators who are advocating for censorship are pointing to laws like SOPA as kind of an example of international norms and why actually censorship is a good idea. Then there's this other issue with sovereignty, which is this is a world map of social networks, and all of this blue are all the countries where Facebook is the most popular social network, and you'll see a few other colors. The pink is Orkut because Brazil is, very unique, and that's like a whole other subject we won't get into. But Russian-speaking countries are using other social networks. They use Facebook as well, but predominantly the most popular social networks are run by Russian companies. In China, Facebook is blocked, so Chinese companies are the predominant social networks. But what's interesting is that you have Facebook kind of creating this overlapping sovereignty in a way where people all over the world are using this platform to challenge the sovereignty of their own government, and then the governments then try to push back, and China has pushed back so much that they're keeping Facebook out entirely. I like to talk about these companies as the sovereigns of cyberspace, in that what we're seeing, and I have a section in the book where I talk about internet companies, and they, be it Facebook or Google or Amazon or any number of other platforms, are making decisions about what their users can and cannot do, making decisions about terms of service, making decisions about how privacy is managed, how your identity is managed, that end up affecting the way in which you not only relate to your peers socially, but end up affecting your relationship with your government. Yet, these private sovereigns are not accountable to the public interest in the same way. They're making commercial decisions based on, what will make their platform most effective and profitable and desirable for the majority, without necessarily thinking about how do certain settings or certain terms affect their most vulnerable users, who may be in danger by a sudden privacy setting or by a policy that requires people to use their real names. And actually, one example that I talk about in the book is an anti-torture Facebook group called We Are Khaled Saeed, which was set up in 2010 around the death of a young man who was beaten to death by police. And this became a rallying point for protest that ended up being a central factor in people gathering in Tahrir Square on January 25th last year, and having the protests gain momentum before the internet got cut off. But what was interesting is this Khaled Saeed page went down in late 2010 around Thanksgiving in the United States, because the organizers were putting together a big demonstration, trying to raise awareness for it. But the organizers, including Wael Ghanim, the Google executive who was very active on Facebook, they weren't using their real name because they didn't want to end up like Khaled Saeed with their heads bashed in by the police. And that is a violation of Facebook's terms of service. And so somehow it was called to attention of Facebook's administrators that this page was run by people not using their real name, and it got suspended the eve of a big demonstration. It happened to be around Thanksgiving in 2010, and the organizer of the page ended up getting it reinstated because they had contacts with people in Silicon Valley who were able to talk to people in the human rights community, and they found a woman in the United States who's from Egypt who was willing to administer the page under her real name, and that's how it got reinstated. But these terms of service, this is one example of how the terms of service might be highly advantageous for commercial reasons, but might be very harmful to activists. Now, moving to China, I mentioned China before and that Facebook is blocked in China. The Great Firewall, as we know it, the system of filtering that blocks international web pages that the government considers objectionable, that's only the first layer of Chinese internet censorship. And actually, the bulk of censorship on the Chinese internet is being carried out on Chinese web services that are run by Chinese companies in China. So it's not the blockage of international pages, but Chinese companies themselves that run social networking services, search engines, and so on, internet service providers, are all expected to exercise what's called self-discipline. So they are required to carry out censorship at the government's behest. China's internet companies are required basically to have entire departments of people who are in charge of controlling content. And at Google or Facebook, you've got people kind of dealing with porn and hate speech and, so on. in China, you have people dealing with that stuff, but you also have people taking down political content and trying to anticipate all the political content that is going to get their company in trouble. So they kind of proactively take down a lot of content. And this is a ceremony I attended in 2009 where the top 20 websites in China receive what's called the Self-Discipline Award. And Robin Lee, the CEO of Baidu, was one of those recipients. And so this is one of the features of Chinese internet censorship and surveillance that it's actually carried out primarily by private sector companies, by the technology platforms and services, not necessarily by police, and that the companies that run China's internet services and platforms are acting as an extension of state power. And I argue that China's kind of exhibit A of what happens when you get unaccountable companies combined with unaccountable governments in the internet age. And while people do have more freedom, you know, they feel more free now in being able to expose some injustices at the local level and so on. The government is able to control it thanks to the help of the companies sufficiently enough that if you try to organize an opposition party in China or you try to publish a treatise calling for multi-party democracy, you go to jail as you always have. And this is an example of some of the censorship. This is Baidu, which is best known for its search engine, but it also runs a blogging platform and social networking services. And this was an article I attempted to post about Liu Xiaobo, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, who's in jail, and I couldn't even publish it. I get this message saying, "We're sorry, your article contains objectionable material. Please check it." You know, so it's not just a matter of being able to get around the firewall. It's that there's a lot of content that's just kept off the Chinese internet altogether by the companies. And this is kind of a fun example. Deutsche Welle, which is a German broadcaster, so a lot of Western media that are trying to reach Chinese audiences are using Chinese social media because that's how you reach audiences these days, through social media. And so they had a page on Weibo, which is the Chinese version of Twitter, you know, posting to their stories and so on. And they got their account deleted. And so then they create another account. And they kind of wrote this cheeky message saying, "We never did anything against Chinese law. We never touched any taboos as set out in the terms of service. We don't understand why we got shut down." And then they got sort of an admin notice saying, "Final warning, your account is going to be deleted if you are dishonest again." And sure enough, they then got this message saying, you know, their account was deleted, and when you tried to go back to their page, you got this error message saying, "We're sorry, this page does not exist." And so that happens a great deal with people who kind of misbehave in the social networking space in a way that the hosting company feels is going to get them in trouble. So the whole point is, with all of this, is that increasingly citizens' relationship with government is mediated through our digital platforms and services, through the internet. And so the question is, how do you ensure that this digital world through which we are mediating this relationship evolves in a way that favors the citizens and empowers citizens rather than manipulates or constricts citizens or empowers the companies and the governments more than citizens on balance? How do we ensure that happens? And this is particularly complicated, just to move the chart in a different kind of set of dimensions. You know, you've got citizens, again, their relationship with government mediated by the companies that run the mobile services, the internet platforms, the internet service providers, and so on. Now, in kind of the traditional sense of thinking about how do you hold a company accountable to the public interest, right, in the traditional democratic sense, the idea would be is that, okay, citizens have elected their government, so the government is accountable to the citizens. So, therefore, if the companies are doing things that are violating people's privacy or otherwise, you know, you don't like or not in the public interest, you get the government to go and regulate the companies. But there's a few problems with that, which is one is that companies increasingly have a great deal of interest on who's getting elected. And as we've seen with the SOPA legislation, certain industries end up having a great deal of influence on the shape of legislation. So you're not quite sure if the government going and regulating the companies is ultimately going to favor the citizens or not. And then the companies, of course, in shaping their platforms are also shaping kind of, are influencing the citizens in different ways. And so one of the things I argue in the book is that increasingly, in order to kind of counterbalance this this kind of lack of, you know, the fact that we can't count on governments to represent our interests and help to make companies more accountable, is that increasingly we're going to have to engage, or we need to engage more directly with companies to get them to be more accountable and really act as constituents, and engage in our own direct lobbying with companies, exercise our power as consumers and investors. And, you know, there are some examples where people are starting to get companies to listen to them, although there needs to be a much broader movement. The other problem is, of course, that you have a situation where it's not nation state by nation state, right? So a government will pass laws that go impact people in other countries who have no influence on who is running that government. So they're not accountable to those people. And then, of course, the companies are doing things, shaping their platforms that influence what people can do all around the world, and then have all kinds of impacts on those people's relationship with the government. So then the question is, do you need people from all around the world, not just kind of in one nation state, but from all around the world to be trying to influence the companies directly? Because there's not too much they can do about the other governments so much. But as consumers and constituents of these company services, they might be able to influence the companies a bit more. So then that's an interesting question. So you've got sovereignty and power. The point being is that the way in which power is exercised and the way in which sovereignty and accountability tends to work in sort of according to democratic nation states, is not preventing abuses of power from happening. And we do not have the mechanisms to hold power accountable in this globally networked world. It's not matching up. And just to give you a break from too many complicated charts, we move on to Monty Python. This is my favorite clip from Holy Grail. I'll let it speak for itself, and then I'll explain.
There's majority in the case of
be
more...
Be quiet! I order you to be quiet!
Order? Who does he think he is?
I'm your king.
Well, I didn't vote for you.
You don't vote for kings?
Well, how'd you become king, then?
The Lady of the Lake, her arm clad in the purest shimmering samite, held aloft Excalibur from the bosom of the water, signifying by divine providence that I, Arthur, was to carry Excalibur. That is why I'm your king.
Listen, strange women lying in ponds distributing swords is no basis for a system of government. Supreme executive power derives from a mandate from the masses, not from some farcical aquatic ceremony.
Be quiet!
But you can't expect to wield supreme executive power just because some watery tart threw a sword at you.
Shut up!
I love this clip. I could just show this clip with no particular excuse at all, but I actually, I was one of those teenagers who had the whole movie memorized at some point. But the point of showing this clip is actually to make a point that relates to the book. What's so fun about this clip and what makes it so funny is that it juxtaposes, it sort of mashes up two completely different ways of thinking about state power. So the first way is the divine right of kings, that the king is anointed by God, and therefore he rules over us, and we must just submit, and if we're good citizens, he'll be nice to us, and everybody will be happy. And that's the way, you know, up until a certain point in time, that's the way how everybody assumed. That's just the natural order of things. There's no other possible way of organizing state power. But then you had evolution, right? You had political evolution. You had about 800 years ago, the barons of England decided King John was a crappy king, and that even though he may have the divine right to rule, he needed to be constrained by a set of principles and laws, and if he didn't abide by them, they would deny him loyalty. And so they forced him to sign the Magna Carta. And that was the first kind of challenge to this notion that divine right of kings, you know, was the only way to run a government. These guys had kind of decided divine right of king wasn't working so well for them, you know, actually. And the Magna Carta was the first manifestation that there might be some other way of organizing power and governance. It took about 800 years before, along the way, John Locke developed his theory of consent of the governed, and you had the English Revolution, and then eventually the American Revolution, which was actually the first attempt, successful attempt, to implement consent of the governed as a governance system. And so that's kind of now how we assume governance is supposed to work, that you, if a government does not derive its legitimacy from the consent of the people, it is illegitimate and can be overthrown. And to different degrees, most certainly democratic political systems on the planet today are based on this notion, but also based on the notion of a physical polity within a physical area, a physical nation. And for all the reasons I just explained, the physical nation state, democracy within the physical nation state, is no longer ensuring that the rights and interests of everybody who's using the internet are protected, be it within your own nation state or within others. So we're kind of recognizing that nation-state-based consent of the governed isn't working so well for us anymore, that there are all these disconnects in terms of how you hold power accountable, in terms of how you prevent, constrain power, prevent the abuse of power, which is kind of what democratic governance is supposed to be about. It's not working so well on the internet based on our current political and geopolitical constructs, but we don't know how to get to consent of the networked yet. We're just recognizing, we're kind of at that Magna Carta moment where we're recognizing that the old system isn't working so well in a digitally networked world, but how to get to consent of the networked, we're a long way from figuring that out. One other thought as well, I really like to cite mentor of mine and Ethan's and perhaps others, Rosenthal Alves, who's a Brazilian journalist who runs the Knight Center for Journalism in the Americas down at the University of Austin, Texas. And he likes to talk about digital society, or I should say the way in which we've kind of handled our information society both before and after the internet. And he talks about our information ecosystem and the way in which we handled kind of information governance structures in the pre-internet age as a desert. It was an economy of scarcity. It was political systems based on scarcity and kind of oases and so on. And then the rains came, and now we're in a jungle. We're in a rainforest and all these new organisms, and we need to build a new civilization in the rainforest. And it requires completely different approaches to our political economy and to the way we organize a society and how you keep people safe and how you deal with resources and all these kinds of things. And we haven't quite worked it out yet, or we're a long way from figuring out how to build this civilization in cyberspace in a way that really accommodates the rights and interests of all of the people within it. And in the book, I talk. I have a chapter where I deal with the digital commons. And sitting here modestly in the back, we have Tim Berners-Lee, who is of course an important figure in creating the digital commons, which is that, of course, the internet as it exists today and the World Wide Web as it is today are based on a set of open standards that are shared, that people build upon in a distributed way, that innovation that does not require permission from a central source, and a great deal of code being generated, content being created, worlds being created, sometimes for commercial motive, but oftentimes not, for a whole variety of different social motives that are helping to construct the infrastructure that is shared, kind of the shared resources, social resources of this new digital civilization. And so, of course, the critical thing is how do we ensure that we continue to nurture a robust digital commons going forward. And I also talk in the book about how activists use the digital commons and how important it is for dissent and political discourse and controversial speech to have a robust digital commons, and that one of the many ways in which the Arab Spring situation differs from, let's say, the Chinese situation is that in the Middle East, North Africa, you have a much freer digital commons than in China. And the Chinese government's ability to kind of squeeze that commons and control it has been one part of many reasons why I don't think you're going to see an Arab Spring type phenomenon happening in China terribly soon. And just to wind down, just to talk a little bit about some of the components I discuss in the book that involve our kind of experimentation towards building the new civilization. We're now experimenting with what internet governance wonks call multi-stakeholder internet governance, and the idea that a lot of the internet's resources and technical standards and so forth should not be managed just by governments, but by collection of, you know, sometimes with government participation, but also the engineering community and non-government organizations and private sector groups and so on, and that it's got to be sort of a collective, a multi-stakeholder approach to deciding how the internet is structured. Otherwise, you'll end up having a situation where solutions don't actually work technically and end up favoring regimes that you do not want making decisions about internet standards. You're also seeing movements to kind of declare rights on the internet, and this is one of many efforts. It's called the Internet Rights and Principles Coalition, and they've kind of taken the International Declaration of Human Rights and various UN covenants and tried to explain how that should apply to the internet and how basically companies and governments ought to be adhering to these standards in different ways in terms of policy. You've got groups like the Global Network Initiative that I'm affiliated with, I help launch, that are trying to get the corporate sector to adhere to basic principles on free expression and privacy and be held accountable to those principles. The idea being that, you know, the business of business may be business, but given that the public square is now hosted by these private spaces, there are obligations that companies need to meet if we are going to have the kind of world that's worth living in, and that we need to work with companies to convince them that this needs to be taken seriously. There are efforts at transparency that some companies are experimenting with, the Google Transparency Report, where they're publishing data about government requests for information, government requests to take down content. The need for people to understand how that intersection between government power and corporate power over our information is very important. It would be, I think, a real step in the right direction if all companies were required to release this kind of data, but also if governments were required to be much more transparent about how they're accessing our information and how surveillance is conducted, which is a whole other conversation we can talk about in the Q&A. And also there just needs to be a lot more, I think, organized pushing of companies to change policies that people don't like. And there's been actually an interesting and I think encouraging example with users of Google Plus lobbying Google to change their identity policies on G Plus. And there are still issues, but they have made changes to allow pseudonyms, at least in some cases where before they weren't allowing them at all. It's an interesting step towards trying to figure out, can we kind of engage in collective bargaining with companies as users, and how far can we go? If we get a lot more organized, how much farther might we be able to take it? Company-targeted activism. And then, of course, the need for people to get much more political with our own elected representatives in terms of internet-related legislation. And one of the problems in this country, but also across the democratic world, is electorates aren't really paying attention to a lot of the law enforcement regulations and laws that are being passed to fight cybercrime or pornography or to deal with copyright and so on, that they're not front and center political issues. People are not taking these up with their politicians and saying, I'm going to vote based on whether or not you care about my digital rights. But we're starting to see now with SOPA and PIPA that people are starting to get much more politically active around this. And this is another important part of that equation. And just to wrap up, of course, I will wrap up with my favorite photo from Occupy Wall Street, which, you know, let's figure this shit out together. We're at the Magna Carta moment. We're not at the American Revolution moment or the you know, Constitution writing moment. We're still quite some way from figuring out how to build the civilization in the rainforest. We're still coming out of the desert governance mindset, but we need to move forward. And the only way we are going to move forward is that if everybody who uses the internet, everybody who uses technology, everybody who's involved with creating it or in regulating it takes responsibility, takes personal responsibility in whatever way we can for ensuring it evolves in a way that is compatible with the kind of world we want to have, because it's not determined that the internet is going to become, you know, that it's going to facilitate abuse or liberation. It really depends on how we shape it. We need to do a lot more actively to make sure it evolves in the right direction. So with that, thank you very much. Thank you.
In the spirit of figuring this shit out together, we're looking forward to opening this up to a Q&A, but I wanted to put a couple of people on the spot and let them offer reactions or questions to Rebecca as sort of first speakers there. So we brought in, it's a pretty remarkable local community here of people who live and work on the internet, and so we brought sort of two of the local stars. One is new to Cambridge, but we're thrilled to have him here. So I wanted to bring up Miha Sifri, who's the co-founder of Personal Democracy Forum, which is one of the best conferences on issues of really how technology is transforming the political process, and there's a million other things about him, and he's wonderfully famous, but we're not going to take up all the time. We're going to let him talk about Rebecca instead. Thank you for being here, Miha.
Thank you, Ethan. And thank you, Rebecca. That was a great talk, and I love the book. I'm using it
thank
in my
you.
Class. I'm teaching, actually. I'm only here for 3 months. I'm teaching at the Kennedy School a new course called The Politics of the Internet, and we're going to be doing much of the last two or three classes will be devoted to your book, so maybe we can sell a few. But that said, I actually want to complicate the conversation because it could be a little depressing to sort of, given the talk that Rebecca gave. I always come to this with a perspective of someone who wasn't originally from the net. Mm-hmm. And so I'm always thinking, well, yeah, but was it really worse before?
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, you know, if you think that, you know, 10 years ago, the only way to have any chance of having effective voice in the political process here in the West in the United States, let's talk about the U.S., was either you had to have a lot of money or you had to get through gatekeepers who themselves made their decisions mostly on commercial terms. So I always see what we have now as better. I mean, I think the flowering of discourse. But I think we need to be careful, we netheads, to not miss the other things that are going on that threaten the possibility of democracy, which we have yet to obtain. I think the internet favors participation and freedom. At the moment, we should include in a talk about the potential consent of the governed, which we don't even have, the fact that just yesterday we learned that 90 people gave cumulatively $50 million to try to affect the presidential election. Mm-hmm. We are back to the bad old days of Watergate, and we don't even know where some of this money is coming from. Okay, so the problem is bigger. That's point number one. Point number two, I'd love to get your thoughts on which would you prefer, that some of these commercial internet companies who we sort of rely on for so much of our network public sphere, is it better if they're run by the founders like Larry and Sergey, who for reasons that I think may be good, seem to care about some of these issues, even if it doesn't help their bottom line? Or is it better if they're just a public company where the founders no longer have a say? You pinned them down as these digital sovereigns, but some of them at least seem to have values that go beyond their bottom line. And then the last thing is WikiLeaks. Mm-hmm. Which is worth mentioning here, not as much in the news as it used to be, but WikiLeaks, say what you will about Julian Assange, put that to the side. WikiLeaks actually succeeded in getting around censorship and forcing the publication of documents that the United States didn't want published. And in part because the network made sure that it couldn't be suppressed. Yes, they've gone after their you know, the ability to fund them. I mean, there have been all kinds of extra parliamentary attacks on them, which Yochai Benkler, I think, wrote a great paper about. But at the end of the day, they pushed this, you know, this issue of sovereignty and international, you know, is there room for some kind of meta-national force? Mm-hmm. WikiLeaks is kind of a demonstration project of what's possible. So I'd love it if you would address those points.
Okay. Well, how much time do we have? How many hours do we have? I guess the first point, I mean, I have a section in a chapter called Lobbynomics, and you know, I sort of raise Larry Lessig's critique of, you know, he stopped working on copyright directly and is now working on campaign finance reform because he's concluded that a lot of these core problems with bad law are never going to be fixed until you fix the political system. And that's absolutely, you know, a major problem. I completely agree. And it's getting worse. And that is a real problem. And again, the thing is, however, how much do we have ourselves to blame for allowing it to have gotten worse and for not having pushed enough as an electorate to get it changed? And how powerless are we? And what more could we be doing? Is this SOPA-PIPA thing a demonstration of if you can really get people to care, actually you can stop things that seem like they're kind of inevitable or that people in Washington assumed were inevitable? And is this, again, one of those many cases where the public is kind of asleep? And how do we wake up the public on that? That's kind of one. That's the subject for somebody else's next book, perhaps. What was the second question? The third question was WikiLeaks. Whether you have a company run by founders or the just kind of a publicly listed company that's, you know, I think I mean, founders, you know, you've also got Mark Zuckerberg, you know, so who imposes an ideology that, you know, I find pretty troubling. You know, it's like, you know, it's the luck of the draw, really, you know, whether the founder is, you know, has values that are a bit more consistent with human rights or not. And, you know, with listed companies, yeah, I mean, I think there's a whole other debate that other books have been written about short-termism of listed companies and when companies are slave to quarterly earnings and quarterly profits, that they're not thinking about the long-term value that they're either providing to shareholders or to society, and this results in thinking and decisions that end up being a lot less ethical and, you know, a lot less kind of positive for society in the long run. And so there's a whole debate about, you know, when it comes down to kind of sustainable practices in companies, you know, environmentally sustainable practices or labor practices, and to what extent is, you know, kind of the way that, you know, corporate financing is structured today kind of contributing or not to companies making socially responsible decisions. And again, that's like a whole other set of books and conversations around that, which this ties into. But it also ties into the issue of, you know, which is goes beyond the internet, of socially responsible investing. And you've got, I mean, I'm very close to some people who work for socially responsible investment firms who go and have meetings with the head of, you know, Exxon and, you know, major multinationals and say, you know, if you don't change this, that, and the other, we're going to pull our stock. And changes do get made, you know. And to what extent are socially responsible investors thinking about free expression of privacy as part of their criteria? They're starting to. But it's very early days. To what extent do you have consumer activism around free expression and privacy the way you've had for decades around sustainable and responsible environmental practices? To what extent are you really going to need that in order to keep companies honest? You know, and what other structures, and this is why I kind of talk about why we kind of need innovation in terms of how we relate to companies, that whether or not you have founders or whether or not you're a listed company, we don't have the mechanisms to keep companies honest while still allowing them to be companies, you know, to hold them accountable to human rights standards. The time has come where we need to do that. We need to figure that out. And I argue that for an internet company, it's in their long-term commercial interest to adhere to and respect and uphold human rights standards. If the whole point of your product is to have people trust you and use it, if nobody trusts you, I think in the long term your value is highly eroded. And you can create a great deal of value if you're bolstering trust. And so, again, it's in part, you know, goes beyond internet companies to a whole question of socially sustainable business practices and what kind of investment structures, what kind of corporate governance structures need to support that, as well as the regulatory structures and everything else. So I've answered that too long. WikiLeaks, okay, do we have an hour?
We don't.
You know, we don't. So, yeah, I mean, I love your quote where you said, you know, I don't know if I'm, you know, what I think about pro or anti-WikiLeaks, but I know I'm anti-WikiLeaks. And I fully agree with Yochai Benkler and his essay who points to, you know, whatever you think of WikiLeaks, the erosion of due process around the way in which the speech that, you know, the WikiLeaks as a publisher of speech and the unaccountable ways in which the U.S. government and some other governments and some companies have acted in terms of trying to silence that speech because it's controversial from a company point of view and, you know, undesirable from the point of view of many governments is very troubling. And the failure of, you know, democratic governments to kind of recognize that this needs to be defended as much as the New York Times I'm afraid, is troubling. On the other hand, you know, and so WikiLeaks certainly does point to, I think, yeah, a model of sort of when you get a group of tech-savvy activists together, you can mount a pretty serious challenge to state sovereignty. But I guess the question is then, you know, is WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, you know, the next set of American revolutionaries? Or are they Robin Hood and his band of merry men who are robbing the rich to feed the poor? You know, in that they are, you know, committing an act that involves some commitment of crime, of breaking of some laws and circumvention of a lot of other laws and circumvention of sovereignty and so on. And they've stuck it to the man. And they've kind of exposed hypocrisy and wrongdoing in a lot of places. They've also actually hurt some innocent human rights and democracy activists who were exposed in the cables. And, you know, there's a whole department, you know, the State Department had to set up a unit of people to actually warn and relocate people whose lives were in danger as a result of the cables. And so, you know, it's not unmitigated good by any means. While on the other hand, you know, there are activists in Tunisia who credit WikiLeaks with helping them bring down Ben Ali. So, you know, I mean, there's a lot of mixed, there's a real mixed bag in there. But ultimately, is WikiLeaks, one of the things about WikiLeaks, and also the anonymous movement, which is kind of a separate, you know, not the same thing, of course, but sort of sticking it to the man and committing civil disobedience and kind of exposing and punishing people who this group of folks think are abusing power, but what is it offering as an alternative? They're showing that the system is broken. They're punishing some of the participants in the broken system. They're working to tear them down, but it's not clear what they want in its place. And I haven't seen any ideas about what should be in its place. I'm also a little bit troubled, and this is more about Anonymous than WikiLeaks, about questions of ends justifying means. And WikiLeaks to some extent in terms of innocent people who got very much hurt. And I think some very good diplomats who are no longer able to do good work because of the result, because of what happened. But you know, in the case of Anonymous and hacking, you know, a lot of innocent people whose you know, information has been exposed and you know, have had money stolen and so on. And, you know, again, if your ends and your means, you're sort of calling for world democracy and you're doing things that show you actually don't care if this human being gets screwed, I'm troubled by that, particularly as someone who, you know, I came from, I was not an internet person either, and kind of in my undergraduate days, I studied, you know, the origins of the Chinese and Russian revolutions, which involved a lot of very idealistic people who thought they were saving the world and sticking it to the man, and they were going to create a really fabulous new world. And then look what happened. And so I think, you know, the means matter as much as the ends, and sort of the lack of concern for the means troubles me deeply.
So just two comments before we turn on to our next respondent. We're going to require everybody to ask less interesting questions than Miha, just to ensure that we have a timely discussion here. Second, I also just want to make clear that I actually do see Mark Zuckerberg as the divinely ordained sovereign, but only because people keep confusing our last names, and I keep hoping that someone will write me a check. Moving forward.
I call him Zuckerman, don't
I? I wanted to...
I'm that tired.
No. It wasn't your fault. It happens a lot lately. People ask me whether I'll buy lunch. It's really troublesome. I wanted to move on to bring up Andrew Luman, who is the director of the Tor project. And I don't know who here knows Tor, uses Tor, show of hands. Tor is a remarkable tool that's really working on the front lines of internet privacy and security and doing incredibly important work for people who are reporting from dangerous places, people who are reporting abuse, and people who simply want to find ways to be anonymous online. So I know that these are issues that he's deeply engaged with, and so I wanted to hand over to him. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks. Sounds like a fantastic organization. I should go work for it. thank you, Ethan. I'm going to have a very different sort of response. I was on a flight from London and sort of reading your book, sort of falling asleep. No offense to your book.
That's fine. Just, you're on a flight.
It was like too dark in the morning or something. And I started reading the book, and I started writing down my emotions as I was reading through this book and thinking through. I had a fairly emotional trip to London where I talked to GCHQ, which is sort of like the NSA of Britain, or England or the UK or however you want to refer to it. And I met their human trafficking people, and they have horrible stories. And that depressed the hell out of me. And then the next day, I met with a bunch of students who were not from the UK, who were interested in usable security and privacy, and were absolutely fascinated that the internet isn't censored in the UK. And this was the first exposure to it, and just the sheer raw excitement they had for, think back to the 1990s, internet cheerleaders. So these are the sort of things that are running through my head as I'm reading your book, responding to things. So I did write some stuff down so I don't ramble endlessly. Mostly what I want to focus on was not the negative parts. That as technical organization, as technical people, everyone seems to focus on everything that's wrong. There is a huge amount of stuff that's right in the world. There are excitement of watching new people on the internet. I got reminded of this from a girl from Saudi Arabia who told me all about the awesomeness she can find on the internet now that she's in the UK and doesn't have a home. I spoke to activists from Iran. I spoke to former sex slaves who had just unabashed love for the internet, the ability to go online, the ability to talk to people who are in the same situation from vastly other parts of the world who may not even speak the same language, but Google Translate does a good enough job. They can have meaningful conversations. Things like this are sort of what gets missed in these debates about SOPA and all this other stuff. Many of these people are becoming much more aware of the power they have. While others have said that, you know, if you click, if you like, if you plus one, if you whatever, it's just a little micro bit. They feel the power that, you know, one person does it, three people do it, 30 people do it, 30,000 people do it. And then the Facebook and the digital sovereigns sort of take notice of what is this. There are millions of movements on Facebook. Most of them are fairly silly and ignored, rightfully so. But that's part of the sort of the creative anarchy that comes out of a global audience with all very different perspectives and feelings on things. This point-and-click activism turns people into activists. Things like SOPA, and they're actually not even SOPA, the response to it, where Wikipedia put up their big SOPA black page. That got a lot of people's attention, a lot of people who really didn't care about activism. That's just sort of government nonsense. I ignore that. You know, tell me what Kim Kardashian's doing today. They suddenly cared. They suddenly said, wait, this stuff is going to go away. These communities I talk to, these friends I've made who I've never met, are suddenly could go away. And maybe I should do something about it. And they simply click, and many of them went beyond the click to actually say, hey, I live in America. I can click this button. I can call my representative. And maybe I'll read through a form, but someone made it easy. And the fact is I actually did it. And for many people, that was their first act of doing anything beyond just existing. And that felt empowered. And the sheer power of that is absolutely amazing. The flip side from, because where I was going, I was flying from London to Virginia to go meet the national security people of the FBI, which is a very different trip than my London trip was. There are these forces of darkness, to sound all metaphysical, that are incredibly strong, and they're always waiting, and they're very patient. And many people get sidelined by it, and many people get focused on the darkness so much and the negatives and not the positives. And the internet really scares the hell out of them. The first time, your sovereign borders, your physical sovereign borders are very different than your internet digital sovereign borders. And, you know, scary, ooh, change. We should stop that. And that the basic rights you expect in the offline world should be the same online, if not more so, if not better. And to close, I had this poem from Marianne Williamson going through my head, which was, Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that frightens us most. That's my response.
Wow. That's awesome.
I'm actually going to change the ground rules while Rebecca catches her breath from that and state that the question has to be less provocative than Micha's and less poetic than Andrew's. Okay? So within that constraint, once Rebecca responds, I will then be passing the microphone around. But
I agree. I agree completely. The talk kind of focused more on the issues, but absolutely, this is not a book about how, you know, the internet's making us stupid or the internet is controlled by bad people and it's not empowering. It is. And they're, you know, working with Global Voices and that community, I experience that excitement about how people are using technology and empowering themselves in ways that were inconceivable prior to the internet. And I guess one of the reasons why, one of the several reasons I wrote the book was that I don't want that to change. You know, I want the good to be able to not only continue, but to be amplified. And I want to make sure that the forces of darkness do not dim the potential that we're seeing there. But also I just felt, you know, this is a very different audience here today than the kind of average audience I envisaged for the book, really. That this book was really meant for, you know, people who don't spend all their time thinking about the internet, who use technology but haven't thought too much about kind of what this means for me as a citizen, and what sort of technology's change and its impact on politics may eventually have for our own politics, our own relationship with government, and our own freedoms. And I think a lot of people take a very fatalistic kind of approach, and a lot of policymakers do too. And this was in part aimed at policymakers and some people also in kind of the human rights activism community who just kind of assume that the internet is going to result in more freedom. Therefore, we don't need to worry about kind of those details too much because ultimately the internet sees censorship and routes around it. So don't worry too much about what China is doing, or don't worry too much about what those jokers in Congress are doing, because ultimately the internet will prevail. And I guess one of the reasons I wrote my book the way I did, and I kind of at the end I kind of talked about this, was my concern about, you know, what you might call technological determinism, and that can be dangerous because it can cause people to abdicate personal responsibility for the way the internet is, for the way our society is, and that we need to continue to assert responsibility as people did in the SOPA protests. And which is why it was so inspiring, and the internet enables us to do that. I definitely hope it doesn't kind of come off as a total downer book, because the hope is to kind of say, look, you know, this is a great thing. Here are the challenges that we face if we want to ensure that it remains a great and empowering political space and tool, and we have the power to make it even better, and to preserve what's good about it, but we need to act. So,
all right, so remember, less interesting than Micha, less moving than Andrew, and questions end with a question mark, often interrogative statements that perhaps move upward in tone at the end.
Okay, I'm going to try not to be poetic. Just off of the comment before, I had a friend who was 16, died of cancer, and her best friends she found online because she couldn't leave her house. Mm-hmm. And Make-A-Wish sent her best friends to her, as well as her favorite author, who then published a book based on her, which is now the number one on the New York Times bestselling young adult. So,
wow. less moving than Andrew.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry. In addition, and this is my question. Mythologist Joseph Campbell talked about how if you want to know what the empire is, look to the tallest building in the city. 1400s, I'm going to go fast. 1400s, the church. The church stays powerful and relevant, but then gets substituted by the political palace, the nation state, the tallest building by the 1800s, which then gets substituted, even though the nation state is still powerful, even the church is still powerful, by the multinational corporation, the tallest building in the financial district. But it is now the cloud that is the most powerful thing because it is the highest thing, much higher than any of these buildings. Mm-hmm. So what's happening here is it seems...
So he's not done.
my question is this network that's the cloud... Does it have the potential? Because you talked about the model that Anonymous is not bringing forward. Mm-hmm. What is the model past the Magna Carta, 800 years from now, but it'll be fast forward, hopefully. What does that look like? And does it override the entire concept of empire mm-hmm. and create something truly organic that is democratic in a way we've never seen before?
Yeah. Well, if I knew exactly what the model was, I would have outlined it in the book, which I must apologize for not having done. But I do think it is going to be something organic and decentralized and not some kind of centralized empire of the cloud, as it were, you know. That, again, we need to figure out how to constrain abuse of power. I mean, that's what good governance is all about, to enable enough power to be exercised that, you know, goods are produced, services are, you know, facilitated, that the weak are protected, you know, security of some form is provided, but that power is not abused at the same time. I mean, that's kind of the whole point of governance. And given the nature of the internet, I think that the way that we are going to organize sort of the constraint of power and the exercising of power probably will be much more distributed and organic, and which is why it's kind of hard to say, okay, here's going to be how our, here's the outline and the org chart of our new system of government, you know, for the cloud. You know, it's kind of hard to envision that. I think it's going to emerge because a lot of communities are going to see problems when it comes to abuses or when it comes to rights that they feel they need to assert or interests that need to be pursued, and they're going to take action and sort of innovate in new ways organizationally and technically. And that hopefully if people, you know, again, are sort of keeping in mind that there needs to kind of be solutions in this way, that solutions will be found. But I think we're entering really a messy period, which is why, you know, people are like, so have you written the Magna Carta for the internet age, and do you have the new constitution for, you know, how the internet, you know, ought to be run from here on out? I mean, like, I just don't think it's going to work in such a neatly packaged manner.
I wanted to ask a question about internet censorship in Africa. I noticed on the Google transparency report that you pulled up, there weren't any dots in sub-Saharan Africa. And I'm wondering whether you think that's because oppressive governments in the region don't feel threatened by internet usage or social media usage, or whether they don't have the capacity to censor or something else.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's with the Google's transparency report, what they're showing, what they're reporting on is countries where they're actually responding to government requests. So it doesn't actually mean that there's no censorship in Africa. It just means that if African governments are asking them to take things down or to hand over data, they're not responding, you know, or they're not receiving the requests. Or they're just not set up to kind of process the requests. But there are definitely several African countries where filtering is happening. In fact, Chinese network equipment companies are very successful in China, and one of the many selling points is that, you know, we know how to work with authoritarian governments, and, you know, you can have your network and keep and stay in power too, buy our equipment. You know, we come from China, we know how to do this. You know, so in Ethiopia, there's quite a bit of filtering, and Ethan actually is more of an expert on African internet than I am. But there are a few other countries as well where filtering is happening more. And you know, but part of it too is just you have to have a government that's organized enough with its infrastructure to kind of have its act together to do that as well. And different countries are at different levels in that regard.
And maybe just to mention in passing, so two things. Google's map is showing where they're complying, which in some ways is basically a map of where Google has business operations. And this is probably relevant in the context of Twitter, where Twitter is getting a lot of flack at the moment, and I think in some ways unjustifiably, about announcing that they're going to be very transparent about where they are, in fact, filtering content from. That's not a guarantee that Twitter is going to accede to every request from China or from Thailand. They won't be able to accede from every request from China, and they probably won't. But Google is getting requests from lots of countries in which it is not, in fact, obeying the law, in part because it can afford not to because it doesn't have any assets on the ground. Mm-hmm. The second, really quickly, is that a map like that doesn't show you the scariest form of censorship, which is where you simply lock people up, or, and I'm guessing that Andres' question may go into, or they just kill you.
Right.
And there, Ethiopia is probably where you really want to take a close look, where one of the bravest journalists in that country is in detention for the sixth time in about 7 years. And, you know, and this continues to be a stable and supported ally of the United States. So there's other forms of censorship beyond the tech.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess a quick question. In the diagram where you had the government, the companies, and the citizens, where will you put the rogue or criminal organizations that might have...
That's a good question. Yeah, that's sort of, you know, you have those kind of lurking all around and kind of acting upon all three, you know, kind of attacking and, you know, so on. That would be another layer to put in there, absolutely. And that's, of course, you know, one reason why government is called upon to regulate the internet is to deal with the criminals.
Back for a little bit. Thanks. Prior to the campaign around SOPA, there has been a campaign about internet neutrality. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if you want to comment on that, but more specifically, what's your assessment of the Obama administration in terms of that issue in particular and other issues? If you could be a little more specific.
Yeah.
And why do you think Google, as a corporation, weighed in so heavily on SOPA, but didn't weigh in the same way and use the leverage that it has on internet neutrality?
Well, Google had its own kind of set of interests on net neutrality. To kind of back into it on the Obama administration more broadly, and then I'll come back to net neutrality. In the book, I talk about particularly surveillance and how disappointing the Obama administration has been on surveillance. Before Obama was elected, he talked about reforming the Patriot Act. He talked about getting rid or reforming the FISA Amendments Act, which basically absolves companies of any liability if they collaborate in illegal surveillance by the government. And he advocated reforming all of this. And, of course, he gets into office and, you know, never mind. And, you know, the Congress, there's been bipartisan efforts to reform Patriot Act and kind of bipartisan opposition to reforming the Patriot Act. And the Obama administration has definitely been opposed to reform. And the Department of Justice has certainly been, in terms of the types of legislations it's advocating in terms of data retention and you know, lawful access for law enforcement and so on, has definitely been pushing for more access and as civil liberties will point out, towards weakened accountability. So that's a concern that, you know, over two different administrations now, under two different parties, you're seeing a trend where, you know, while in our physical spaces, in order to search your house, warrants are required. Looking at your email, if it's older than 180 days, no warrant, court order, or anything is required, you know, et cetera. So that's troubling. Net neutrality, I mean, Google had a very specific position on net neutrality. I deal with net neutrality in the book, so and you know, this is one of those issues one can, you know, the details are, you know, very detailed and complex. I would say in the book I do talk about net neutrality, however, because it relates to censorship. And when you allow corporations to discriminate at will, you know, against their traffic, so a company is allowed to say, okay, you know, there's certain services and certain types of traffic that I'm going to prioritize over others, that has implications for political speech, you know. If Comcast is going to prioritize certain big commercial, you know, video streaming sites, let's say, you know, or is going to prioritize YouTube over, you know, the home-hosted videos of Rebecca McKinnon, because YouTube, you know, had to deal with Comcast, that's a problem for free speech, particularly because YouTube has its own terms of service about what can and cannot be on the network. So I talk about net neutrality in the context of free expression and human rights. And, you know, there's a whole other kind of more commercial side of it that I don't get into so much. But what we saw with, you know, what's come to be known as the, you know, Google-Verizon kind of agreement on net neutrality that then kind of was mirrored by the FCC's rules was that, and if... If you have no idea what I'm talking about, read my book, you know, or, you know, but it'll just take too long to explain. But, you know, that on kind of the fixed line internet, broadband, et cetera, when you're accessing the internet through, you know, your Wi-Fi or your computer, it's there is net neutrality required. But if you're on a mobile device, it's not. And in a world where increasingly the most disadvantaged people are accessing the internet only on mobiles, where in the developing world people are accessing the internet only on mobiles, and there's no neutrality requirement, and companies can discriminate, and you end up having situations in some countries, for instance, where mobile phone carriers and Facebook will do a deal where people can access Facebook for free, but if they're accessing kind of like home-hosted blogs, they're paying, you know, a high data fee. And so then you're kind of locked into this environment that's governed by Facebook's ideology and rules in terms of how privacy works and your identity is handled and so on, which in a human rights context can be quite troubling. So net neutrality does matter for free expression and political rights. And I talk about that in the book without, you know, I mean, whole books are written about net neutrality. There's a woman named Dawn Nunziato who's based at George Washington University in D.C. who's written a very good book about net neutrality, and I recommend it for people who really want to read up on it. Google, why didn't Google mobilize the public on net neutrality? Because it made its own backroom deal, you know, with, you know, one of the carriers and with the government, with the Obama administration. So it didn't need to mobilize the netizens, you know. So, you know, Google kind of plays all sides, you know. You know, Google's acting in its own self-interest, as does everybody, really. And I think just not to go on too long, but, you know, I guess part of our question as we're thinking about how do we constrain the abuse of power and how do we constrain manipulation and how do we ensure people's rights are protected is, in the physical world, in a physical democracy, the constraints we put on abuse of power kind of all assume that everybody's acting in their own self-interest, and we've kind of created institutions to balance those out, or we've tried to. And so in the internet space, you know, how altruistic or moral Google is or not, you know, who knows? You know, you have to put their executives on a couch and psychoanalyze them. But I guess ultimately all I care is that if they find it in their self-interest to do things, if they find it in alignment with their commercial self-interests to support policies and support technologies and support technical developments that are consistent with human rights, free expression, and privacy, and an open internet, then fine. I don't care if it's in their self-interest or because, you know, they had some religious revelation. I don't care why, as long as we can incentivize them to be on the right side. So part of it is, how do you incentivize powerful actors to decide that it's in their own self-interest to do the right thing? And so I think, kind of as civil society, as netizens, as we're thinking about how do we deal with these powerful actors and their backroom deals or their technical decisions, how do we kind of move things in the direction of, you know, getting everybody to follow their own self-interest, but in a direction that works for us?
So we've got room for one more question. It's a Twitter-sized question, which is to say that the question needs to fit in 140 characters or less, and Rebecca is going
to
be answering in terms of a bit.ly URL.
Okay.
So if you have a question that works in that context, you can be the last question. We got a hand up. I'm counting characters. Final character must be a question mark.
It's within the same vein. Is it abuse of power to require people to provide their personal information so that you can resell it? Isn't it the wrong way around? Shouldn't I be paid for my personal information instead of having it sold to an advertiser?
Yeah, well, you should only have to, you know, I mean, there are some situations, like if you're consenting because you don't mind that it's resold, that's fine. But, you know, there are some people who, you know, but, yeah, I mean, that would be nice. The question is, you know, how ultimately is what does that business model look like, or would we not have these services at all? And in that case, you know, I mean, how do we negotiate this? I mean, we're clearly in a situation where it's unfair. Our information is being sold. There's not sufficient control over it. Yet at the same time, we're still signing up for these services, or a lot of people are. And a lot of people are, you know, finding that they want to benefit from the convenience and benefits of being on these services. So unless we kind of negotiate a different deal somehow, we shouldn't be surprised if the bad deal continues. But, you know, it's hard to say exactly. Yeah, I mean, of course it's unfair. We're providing very valuable things that these companies are making money off of, but we're also kind of consenting to it. And so we need to think about to what extent are we responsible for this state of affairs, and what might we need to do to change the bargain?
So the bargain we have now is that you've
that
sat
wasn't
here
very bit.ly. I'm
for,
sorry.
No, that was quite good. The bargain at this point is to thank you for being here and supporting Rebecca's book. We're going to feed you, but you have to head to the other room for that. And we would love it if anyone has a copy of the book that Rebecca can sign. She may be signing other things. I'm not entirely sure. I try to leave that up to the authors. Thank you all for being here. Thank you so much, Rebecca. Congratulations.
Thank you.